up happier than ever? No way. He doesn't get to win.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
The census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Gina! But I don't care, darling, because I love you.
Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains. I can feel myself rot.
Sid, don't you blame the movies. Movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative.
Wheel in.
Out with friends?
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, my friend?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hey, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm doing better. How are you, Phil? Are you feeling better?
I'm at the end of the tail end of a 2-week cold, but yeah, I still have it.
Yeah, I had it until about Sunday, and now I'm just dealing with lack of sleep.
Right, right. What's the lack of sleep for?
3 podcasts in 3 days, I guess.
Oh! You had another podcast that you did too.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I had one on Monday night too with Abe to talk about Salem's Lot. So the book. So yeah, this is my third as well. Eric, this is your third as well too.
Indeed.
Yes. And then we have someone, a Connecticut American, it's only her first of the week.
Slacker.
I know. This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Things are going great. Thank you for asking. A little crazy this week was crazy, but that's okay. It's all good.
Yeah, Chrissy, could you go get us some coffee?
Sure, I'm having coffee right now. I'll invite you all over to my home for coffee.
I'm sorry, it's a
deadly
ground
coffee.
It's a joke pertaining to the film we're discussing today.
Oh, okay, I get it now.
That
all
thing,
right.
Yeah.
For Pam, that's from The Office, but Pam, the wife of Mike, asked us to give the date of this recording, and this is September 26, 2019 at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is a Thursday, so for folks who are curious when we recorded this. For folks who wonder who we are, who are new to this podcast, Dark Discussions Podcast is a podcast that discusses horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, midnight movies, drive-in movies, and cult films and things of that nature. Basically, we talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence, and rather than just review, we also critique. Eric, now where can people find us on the internet?
Oh, they can find us at darkdiscussions.com. That would be one place to start. Darkdiscussions.com is our main website. There's a bunch of stuff on the website. On the front page on the right-hand side, you'll find links to Friends of the Podcast. Up at the top, you'll find a few links. You'll find a link to an articles section where there are articles written by myself as well as others. You'll find a link to the audio section where we have every episode of Dark Discussions plus all the other spin-off podcasts available for free. I'm sure there's more than one topic that you'd be interested in listening to if you haven't listened to all of our shows already, so go check that out. And front and center on the front page is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon allows you to financially support your online artists. producing this podcast is not free, so if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this podcast, you can click on that link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. For every $5 a month that you'd care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly do a show on. We take all the topics submitted by all the patrons and draw them randomly on a quarterly basis to do a show on a topic picked by one of our patrons. For more information, you can follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
And for folks who want to listen to us, as you probably know, you can listen to us pretty much wherever podcasts are found or at darkdiscussions.com, where every episode is available. Also, we do have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where you can email us and give us your feedback, critique, suggestions, what you've seen that you're interested in, what you've seen and want to review it, and we will read your emails on the podcast. Also, we have a Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, so just search for Dark Discussions Podcast on Facebook, and we will let you join. Basically, there's a lot of discussion right now on the Joker movie over there, on the She-Hulk. There's stuff about various horror films as well, such as It Chapter 2, and I believe there may have just been some more new discussions on the Chucky film, because it just has been released on VOD and disc, the remake and such. So a lot of good stuff over there. People can go check out our Facebook group. One big news we should mention, I'll let Mike discuss the passing of someone, because I think you've met him, and you actually put a nice little blurb on Facebook about him.
Yeah, it was the passing of Sid Haig, who has, in the last 15 years, become a genre icon. you know, Sid had a very respectable career as a character actor, for about the first 30 years of his career, but he was always being cast, as he put it, as someone who points a gun at somebody, and he kind of got tired of being typecast, so he quit in the early 90s. It's kind of hard to pinpoint dates when he quit acting, because, you know, when you finish acting in a job, you know, may not be the when you decide to quit, because who knows how long he was looking for work, who knows, you know, and then when the date of his last thing was released. But it was about a decade that he took off, most of the 90s. And he had been in stuff, if you are our age, by which I'm 49, Phil's 49, Eric is younger than that, and Chrissy, I think you're younger than that.
Yeah, Chrissy's 48 and Eric's 46,
yep,
I think.
I'm 48. I'm 48.
Okay, you let the lady say
I'm 39.
Sure you are.
But if you grew up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you saw him in something. You had to have. You might not have noticed him. He wasn't a character actor like, say, Dick Miller, who, you know, fans kind of recognized him immediately. But he was in a ton of things. I mean, for me, my first stuff I saw him because it was stuff that I was watching before I was in kindergarten. It was like Batman and Star Trek. He played King Tut's henchman in Batman and the Lawgiver in Return of the Archons in Star Trek. He was in Buck Rogers. There was I think it was the place I knew him best, because when I first saw him, I was bugging because I couldn't place his face. He played the villain in a Saturday morning TV live action series called Jason of Star Command. You know, that lasted for, I think, a season, and I think streaming on Amazon Prime. But, you know, he had done something like 7 episodes of Mission Impossible. He had done Gunsmoke. He had done The A-Team. He had done Dukes of Hazzard.
He'd done a bunch of Roger Corman films.
Jack Hill blaxploitation films like Coffee and Foxy Brown and
also non-blaxploitation films by Jack Hill as well, including Spider Baby.
And then Spider Baby was, you could argue, his first big film role, where he worked with Lon Chaney Jr. But anyway, so he'd been around for a long time. He had been offered in 1990, 93, early 90s, after he would quit, he had been offered the role of Marcellus Wallace in Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino, Tarantino being, of course, a big fan of the Jack Hill films.
Damn, he dropped the ball on that one.
And he's been kicking himself, well, ever since, until last Saturday. He admits that was the biggest mistake of his life. But he did end up with doing a cameo in Jackie Brown as the judge, and he was playing the bartender in Kill Bill Volume 2.
So you know what's interesting about the Jackie Brown film? That had been the first time he had seen Pam Grier in like 28 years or something. And she looked at him and said, was asked if it was him. And then that was like this big reunion. It was kind of funny. Because they had done like five or six films together, both Carmen films and blaxploitation films.
And I remember him saying, I guess he had done it must have been the first film he did with her, and she was kind of coming on to him. And then someone was like, hey, she's only 17. And he was like, oh, well, 17 will get you 20. And, you know, just wanted, you know, and kind of had to back off of that. So he takes the 10 years off. He comes back because Rob Zombie also remembers him. Cast him as Captain Spaulding in House of a Thousand Corpses. And people maybe didn't realize it at the moment, but Captain Spaulding ends up becoming one of the horror icons of the new millennium, whether it's through House of a Thousand Corpses or The Devil's Rejects. I actually had a student in my class wearing a Captain Spaulding t-shirt today. I know he knows who Sid Haig is and that he died. So it was kind of cool. But anyway, I think what really, and he's done now dozens of films ever since. A lot of low budget stuff like Death House, like Hatchet 3. He's done just about every podcast you could find. You know, where anyone wants to interview him, he's pretty much done an interview. And there's a whole ton of stuff, really good stuff you can find on YouTube, I'm sure, or on podcasting. But he hits the convention circuit, and I think that's really what sold it, because he's been my Facebook feed, which admittedly, my Facebook friends, I have a small smattering of colleagues and former students and friends and family outside the podcast, but it was the podcast was the only reason I got onto Facebook in the first place. And so everything I almost all of my Facebook friends are friends either through the podcast or through things I've done for the podcast, like doing conventions. So we've mentioned many of them, horror icons who have passed away in the last 8 years that we've been doing this show. I've never seen anything quite like this, where my entire feed was tributes to and stories about Sid Haig, and everyone telling their stories about meeting him, or sharing a story that he told, because this guy had been around so much and done so many things. He'd told so many great stories about whatever job he had, whether, you know, it's working for Jack Hill or Roger Corman. And one I really liked was by Wolfie. It was the Dorkening did a Sid Haig thing the other night, and I jumped on. And it's was the Wicked Horror Show.
Yeah, that's the name right there.
Yeah, so their Wicked Horror Show is Wolfie on the Wicked Horror Show shared a story that he was in Roger Corman's Galaxy of Terror, which was an Alien knockoff around 1980,
I just got their metal box there. What's that for?
Oh, the steel box.
Yeah, the steel box. Because it has a 4K scan on it. Yeah, but continue, I'm sorry.
So. Sid was like lobbying them to change his character in the film. And he basically changes his character into a silent character. He has absolutely no dialogue. And Roger Corman asked him, why did you take away, have them get rid of all your dialogue? And he said, have you read the script? Because the script was just so terrible.
I like the film though. It's good. Good.
No, I like the film, but that was his point, was that his dialogue was just so
specific character. Yeah, that's what I heard.
I mentioned when I met him through Dark Discussions at Horror Realm in 2012. That was my second year there. I decided to get the VIP ticket, which was like $75, which is not a lot since they were, I'd been given a media pass and free entrance into the convention anyway, and $75 is usually a bargain for a VIP pass.
Yeah, that is. Holy crap.
And it wasn't a well-attended convention, and he came in Friday night, and there was a party in the penthouse suite or whatever in the hotel, whatever you call it, and he came in late. He was tired. He was hungry, but he still kind of put in his appearance. He sat there for about stood there for about 30 minutes in a circle with me and six, seven other fans, and kind of held court for, you know, about a half an hour and answered all of our questions. And he was, you know, very, very generous. And I know I told the story before about, like, I had wanted to ask him about working with Lucille Ball because he'd worked with her twice. And his first response, and I don't remember if he used the word or not that he was above using foul language frequently, but he basically said she was a bitch. And then he said, well, you know, to be fair, she was in the middle of a spat with Vivian Vance the first time he worked with her. And she was, you know, she was perfectly fine. She was, you know, very lovely the second time he worked with her, but the first time she was, you know, she was rough to work with. And I asked about Lon Chaney Jr. and he said, who he worked with on Spider Baby. And he said, you know, cause Lon Chaney Jr., as most genre fans know, is infamous for his alcohol issues. And Sid just stood up for him. And he said that, you know, you say what you will about his drinking, he was an absolute pro on set. He never came to the set drunk, you know. So you know, and he wanted to make sure the record was clear on that, you know, which was nice. But this was a guy you saw him at a convention. He had a hug for anybody that wanted a hug. He you know, spent time with you. He never rushed you along to get to the next person, no matter how long his line was. He told his fans, you know, that he'd made enough money in his life. He is not going to ever raise his prices on his autographs. And you know, the fan conventions have exploded in the last 10 years, and I've seen since I started hitting the conventions again in 2011, I've watched the prices go from 20 to 30, and I think the average price is for an autograph is 40, and that's often for even low rung celebrities. And Sid, you know, Sid's not Robert Englund, he's not Bruce Campbell, you know, but he could certainly charge at minimum of 40, probably more. When he was doing photo ops, you know, for Scares the Care, I think it was for 60, and all of that money went to the charity, the professional photo ops with him in costume. And his price had always been $10 to sign something you bring, $20 to sign something off of his table, you know, and it never changed. And I know other celebrities had made similar pledges and didn't follow through on it. So the fans kind of loved him. I always made sure to stop by and at least say hello. He had no idea who I was. I want to be clear about that. I probably saw him at about 7 or 8 conventions in the last 8 years. But especially with Scares the Care, I always thanked him because I know he did a lot of work for the charity. I know he paid his own way to go to the Scares the Care convention. I know he gave most of what he got at his table to the convention. One year he cut them a $10,000 check.
Holy crap.
After the convention, which for a guy in his 70s who was a B-movie actor, you know, who was, you know, never a star, a $10,000 check is not an insignificant amount of money. I'm sure he had a nice, comfortable life, but, you know, that was a nice check. And so everyone kind of knew this was coming. The fans at Scares the Care, when we saw him 2 years ago, and he came every year except for one, and I don't remember if it was that. He was filming something, he was sick. Noticed last year that he was very gaunt. He'd lost a lot of weight.
When we saw him at ScareCon in Springfield, and he was having breakfast at like 2 tables from us, and you could tell that he was winding down, unfortunately.
Yeah. And, you know, when you get to a certain age, and you don't know when it's going to happen, it's not like it's clockwork, but it's amazing how quickly your body can deteriorate. But I know that there were, you know, within a year, he went from being looking like Sid Haig, who was a kind of a burly kind of guy, to looking old and frail and having trouble talking somewhat. His memory
His height. I mean, not his height. His weight was back to when he was in the Roger Corman films from the 70s, the last year or two. Because, like you said, he used to be more of a huskier guy when, you know, he was in the Rob Zombie films and whatnot. And then, but when in the 70s, he was a thin, lanky guy. And
right,
you could tell that with a quick late weight loss at that age, you figured that, yeah, it was unfortunate.
So, you know, it's I really think that it's just the cultivating the fan base, not in a calculated merchandising way, you know, or marketing way, just in the fact that he was a genuine guy. He really loved the fans and the friends he's made. And we've known people who are friends with him because of, you know, work at Scarecon or Scares the Care, the people who work behind the scenes who have gotten to know him. And through them, other convention people that have spent time with him that he would consider friends, you know, and they all say that he really did love the fans and he loved the fan base and I think that was genuine. And I think the fans, that's a reason the fans loved him back, is that he always kind of gave back to that community. And, you know, this isn't someone like, and I don't mean to besmirch them, like a Robert Englund or Vincent Price or a thing where they're famous because of their character or because of all the great movies they've been in. I think Sid Haig was popular because he was Sid Haig. And it's amazing just how, you know, all the touching tributes that have been out there. I think the sad thing is he was 80 years old when he died. He lived a very good life. He had a happy marriage. His kids were successful. There's, you know, he lived to be 80 years old, so he beat the averages there. It's hard to complain. I think the saddest thing is that this is a man with thousands of stories to tell, and, you know, we're not going to get to hear them anymore. I'm hoping, you know, I don't think he ever wrote a book. I don't know if he ever wrote memoirs or wrote those stories down. I'm sure many people have them recorded somewhere. You know, and it would be nice for someone to finally get those put down somewhere. You know, what was it like working with Victor Bruno on Batman? What was it like, you know, working on Mission Impossible with Martin Landau, or pointing a gun at Sean Connery in Diamonds Are Forever? You know, one of the things I like about the character actors is that they don't tell stories about, like, if you talk to a star, the stars are always the center of their own stories. This is what happened to me when I was on set. The character actors are always kind of on the periphery. They're never the stars. They're never the center of attention. So they see things a little differently. And they often give you a little behind the scenes tidbits of how things really went that you would never know. And the truth is, there's lots of guys like him that are in Hollywood. And some of them do the convention circuit. I always point out Dick Warlock, who have been like the Forrest Gump of cinema. You know, they've been through all these different things. If you have the chance to meet them, take advantage of it.
Yeah, a couple of things. Armenian American, by the way. And when he passed, my wife's, she uses my Facebook account, and she said, "Did someone famous pass? Because there's hundreds of tributes and things about someone that I never heard of before." And I go, yeah. I said, "Hey," and I pretty much told them a truncated version of basically what you just said, Mike.
Yeah, and I mentioned it to a friend of mine, and he said the only thing he'd seen like this was Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And I said, but even with Robin Williams, it was different because everybody loved Robin Williams, or just about everybody loved Robin Williams, except for professional comedians who thought he was a joke thief.
Well, also, Mike, it's kind of hard to compare the two because, again, Facebook, for me, just as it is for you, we're all linked to the horror convention people and the horror podcasting people. So those people are obviously going to be
right,
the
but
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but we lost, like, Gunnar Hansen. You didn't. That's you right. Got tributes. You didn't get anything like that. And I think it just has to do with the fact that because he had that personal connection with so many people, you know, that he when you came to his table, he said something funny, or, you know, if you, you know, yep, he did something, whatever, to make you feel comfortable and welcome, despite he could have a little bit of an intimidating
but
persona.
Yeah, no, You're absolutely right, because I mean, you know, when Toby Hooper, George Romero, and Wes Craven passed again, yeah. You know, but again, these people didn't go to the conventions as much as say this guy. This guy was a mainstay, so everybody who went to the conventions knew of or had seen Sid Haig. So, and like you said, he was great to the fans.
Right, and I think that's what builds up the legend. And I have so much respect for all the people you just mentioned, you know, and all the work they did. But because you know him, even if you don't know him, even if he's not your friend, you know, it's a thing, you know. And even if you only see them once a year, you know, at a convention, it's you still get some weird little familiarity, or you feel it, even if it's, you know, a little bit of an illusion. So he will be missed. Or at least his stories will be missed. So, Godspeed to him, and go watch something that had him in it. I watched I jumped ahead in my reviewing of the old Adam West Batman TV series, which I've been sort of slowly making my way through over the last couple of years, and I fast-forwarded to the two episodes he did with as a King Tut henchman, and he had a surprising amount of dialogue for a Batman villain. And that was fun, but you can find something to watch.
Yep, very well. All right, so I think we can probably get into our topic tonight. So, Eric, why don't let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right. Tonight we are going to be discussing a movie from 1951 called The Thing from Another World.
The Thing from Another World. This is the spot where it was first seen, and these are the first people who saw the thing. How did it get here? Where did it come from? What is it?
That thing's alive, sir. I saw it. I shot at it. I hit it. I know it. Nothing happened. It just kept coming at me, making a noise like a cat mewing. Captain, it was awful. You could have seen those hands and those eyes. Captain, you've got to do something about it. You've got...
Is it human or inhuman? Earthly or unearthly? Baffling questions, astounding questions, that not even the world's greatest scientific minds can answer.
Gentlemen, do you realize what we've found? A being from another world, as different from us as one pole from the other. If we can only communicate with it.
See?
What happened after you?
In the greenhouse, I was working, I couldn't see.
Yeah.
Then a blast of cold air, and I heard Olsen scream.
Come here. Get in the corner. Now hold this in front of you. Stay by the light switch.
1.9. Needles hit the top.
That's right. Thing from Another World is a movie produced by Howard Hawks, directed by Christian Nyby, written by Charles Lederer, and starring Kenneth Toby and James Arness. The film is based off of the novella Who Goes There by the great science fiction author John W. Campbell Jr. And it was released in 1951, and is probably considered one of the greatest, if not the best, 1950 science fiction film in the Hollywood era. Though there's a couple others that are close, but many, many people say this may be the best one from the 50s. It was a fairly successful film. RKO Pictures released it. A big cast of characters and actors who aren't necessarily famous, but would be in the same category as, say, a Sid Haig, where they were back in that era. Everybody knew who they were, even if they didn't know the names. And the film, I guess, based off of it being considered one of the best 50s sci-fi films, critical acclaim throughout. So I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and our first time seeing it and so on and so forth. So let's start with you, Chrissy.
You know, this is kind of an interesting thing with me because I had actually never seen this film before, despite all of the, you know, sci-fi Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, all those 50s things I watched when I was a kid when they were on, you know, Channel 11 or Channel 9 or whatever. But this movie, I never got around to seeing for whatever reason. And I honestly am kind of glad that I didn't see it until now because I really feel like I got more out of it coming to it fresh as an adult. I also had no idea that this was actually like the thing in John Carpenter was actually like a remake or a continuance of the story of this. So Charles had to explain all that to me because I didn't know. And so I thought that was very interesting too. I bought the short story, the novella that this is based on. It's based on a novella called Who Goes There by John W. Campbell. I have not read it yet because I just bought it yesterday, but I am rather excited to read it. And in fact, it opens the actual short story or novella opens on a really exciting scene. So that's good. I enjoyed this. I thought that the special effects for the most part were excellent. I think even for the time period that this movie was made in, they were excellent special effects. And I honestly thought that most of them held up well. Some of the acting, of course, gets a little stiff in places. But I honestly thought the dialogue delivery in this was fantastic. The way these characters talk over each other, they talk like real people. They argue like real people. It just felt very organic to me, which is not something that you get in a lot of films from that era. I thought the script was pretty tight. I thought the information was really clear. But there was also a really strong subtext that was very reflective of kind of what was going on in the United States at the time with regards to, you know, the Cold War and the McCarthy era and all that kind of stuff. So that was very interesting. And I really enjoyed this. I can't wait to watch it again. I definitely was thrilled because I honestly felt, too, that there were some genuinely creepy moments in this. And that's also something that I, having seen a lot of 50s sci-fi, you don't get a lot of that in 50s sci-fi because the stuff just looks so hokey that you're just like, oh my God, like that is so not creepy. But there were some things in here that were really well done. And they were actually chilling. And so anyway, that is my thoughts.
All right. Very good. Eric.
I swear I'd seen this movie before. But it's been so long that this may have well been my first time seeing it. I've talked about this on the show before that I have a little bit of trouble watching older movies, and this one was not an exception. Particularly looking back on the male female dynamic in this movie through the lens of 2019 was particularly weird. But for the time it was made, it's a very good movie. Phil was saying that some consider it the best sci-fi movie of the 50s. I disagree. I think Them tops it by a mile. But that's just my personal opinion. I liked it, but didn't love it. I had the same issue with it that I have with a lot of older movies, as far as how the lines are delivered and the soundtrack and all that. But I'm not trying to crap on it. It's not a horrible movie. It's just from the 50s. And for considering it is from the 50s, it's pretty good sci-fi.
All right. Very good. Yeah, for me, I first heard about this film because my father was watching it at 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. It was WSBK TV, actually, no, it doesn't matter. Channel 56 in Boston. I used to have a Creature Double Feature in an Outer Limits episode every Saturday, but on Friday night, they just had a Creature Feature at 11. And this film never made it to the double feature on Saturday, so I never got to see it. But I walked in before I had to go to bed, and my father told me it was about a vegetable creature. And so I felt that was sounded pretty stupid. But then I had become familiar with the story from a comic book, or I should say a graphic novel that I got as a kid. It had a bunch of stories by all famous sci-fi authors, and this happened to be one that was drawn out as a comic. And so I fell in love with the story. And so finally, I actually saw John Carpenter's The Thing, which is a remake of this film, first. And then in the 90s, I finally saw this film as well as reading the story. And I have the story, John W. Campbell's collection in my bookcase. I love this film. Chrissy made a couple of good points. The dialogue was intentionally where people would talk over each other because they were trying to make it more realistic to get out of what happened back in the 50s, which was, or I should say the 40s and so forth, which was doing movies like they were plays. When they filmed this, some actors actually had problems because they were confused that they wanted – Nyby wanted people to talk over each other because that wasn't what you did in films. And so that was an interesting dynamic. Also, John W. Campbell was a true anti-communist, and as was various other people like Howard Hawks and so forth. So this was most certainly a anti-communist film and short story or novella for that matter. The music I didn't mention by Dmitri Tiomkin is one of the things that I think is the most iconic, especially during the saucer scene. It's really, really good film. One new trivia thing I found out was James Arness, who also actually starred in Eric's favorite film from the 50s, that's a sci-fi, Them. John Arness was one of the stars in that film. I found out yesterday it was actually the old older brother of Peter Graves, and I had no idea. So John Arness and Peter Graves were brothers. Graves was Peter Graves' middle name, and so he just went by Peter Graves, and Arness kept the Norwegian last name from their birth. So that was kind of curious. But yeah, I highly recommend a great film and so forth. Mike?
Part of the reason we're doing this to keep it up on the upbeat track tonight. A month ago tonight, I lost my father, and this was his favorite film. Obviously, my father's the main reason I'm here, along with my mother. But it is, the main reason I'm on the podcast is because my mother and my father both kind of instilled in me a love for films like this. Some of my favorite memories were sitting around the dining room table with my father and talking about movies, so really every time I sit down and do this, it's always will remind me of those conversations. And this was one of the movies he talked about a lot, and he loved reminiscing about it. This came out in April of 1951. So my father would have been 9, and it scared the hell out of him as a kid. I always loved and preferred the remake, the 1981. Or 82 Carpenter film. There are definitely telltale signs here of what Eric would refer to as old movie syndrome, I guess. And there's a lot of things that they do in the film, and we'll talk about it, that nobody would do now or should do now. I could come up with a number of 50 science fiction films that I think are probably superior, like Forbidden Planet, War of the Worlds, Time Machine, maybe The Day the Earth Stood Still. But this is one that I think holds up in part because they hold back so much on the effects. They don't try to show you too much. I know they had a lot of problems with the costume. and the makeup, and so you see very little of the thing himself, and I think that keeps it from being too hokey. You mentioned the music. This is one of the first films to use a theremin. There were, I think, two or three others that had come out in the 40s that had used a theremin. But you
what was a theremin?
Eric, can you describe that?
It's that thing that goes, ooh. It's like, it's very.
Right.
Yeah. But what type of instrument is it?
It is a box. We actually have a theremin. My housemate.
Of course you do.
Yes. My housemate plays a theremin. What it does is it creates a field. I don't know whether it's electrical or magnetic or what, but it's some kind of field. And you move your hands.
It's electrical.
In between these two. Is it? Okay. Yeah. You move your hands in between these two, like, poles. And that's how you make the sound. And they're in the 1950s. I forget her last name, but her first name was Clara. And she was, like, the most famous theremin player ever. And, in fact, we saw her perform at the American Museum of Natural History about, God, it's got to be, like, 20 years ago now. Her first name was Clara. I can't remember her last name. But if there was a movie in the 50s that used the theremin like this one, it was a good bet that she was probably playing it. Because she was, like, the industry's number one, like, theremin player ever. I mean, I'm sure they had other people, but she was, like, a big deal. So I will find her last name, but that's what it is. It's that thing that kind of sounds like, it's,
you know, the opening music of Ghostbusters before the Ghostbusters theme, you know, as you're going through the library, that's
all right, well, we're getting into a lot of theremin stuff. But yeah, it's invented by the Soviet Union by a guy named Leon Theremin from the Soviet nation, and so it doesn't surprise me, Dmitry Tiomkin, who obviously is Russian, would be familiar with the instrument.
Well, just before, just one quick thing here, the guy who did the special effects for this movie is Donald Stewart. And he didn't do a whole lot, but one of the things he did do was Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. He also did Land of the Pharaohs in 1955.
Well, we should get into that after Mike finishes his thing.
Because
the screenwriter, I was going to mention him. He has a lot of big credits, too. But we can bring that up in a moment. But, Mike, sorry, I just wanted to know.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's fine. Go ahead, Mike. Continue what you were
saying. Yeah, so, like I said, so it's definitely a nostalgic film for me. And if someone didn't grow up with that, or doesn't have an appreciation for older films and older styles of storytelling, I don't know how well this film is going to carry over. I think there are films that age better because of there's certain storytelling styles here. But watching this, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before on the podcast because, you know, it's been 400 episodes or – wait, no. Is it 400 episodes?
We're in the 400s, yeah.
Yeah, okay, we are in the 400s. 400, you know, we've talked about everything. But it's just that when you watch a movie you know so well for the podcast or when I do, it's kind of like watching it differently because you scrutinize it in a way that I haven't done in a long time. You know, when a film becomes that familiar to you that you've seen, you know, a dozen times or more, it can easily become background while you're checking email or doing whatever. So stuff like you guys mentioned, the rapid patter dialogue, people cutting each other off in mid-sentence. So not everything's there. There's certainly stuff that's would now be considered politically incorrect, but I think are probably true to the time in terms of like gender roles. And it's, you know, well shot, well lit, atmospheric. There's other things they're just like weird choices in hindsight that I never really picked up on before until I started dissecting it for this. And we'll get to that later, I'm sure.
So, Mike, we have another co-host that couldn't join us. What's his name?
Abe.
Abe, that's right. But he did supply us with his opinion of The Thing from Another World. And, Chrissy, you actually have that message?
I do. I have it right in front of me, so I'm going to go ahead and read it. He writes, I remember first knowing about the film at a young age. My folks used to own some sort of video player that used large rectangular flat cartridges, and one of the movies was The Thing from Another World. It was cool seeing the original title card, knowing that years down the road, John Carpenter would recreate it for his film. Overall, it's a fun little 1950s science fiction flick. Well shot and with a good atmosphere for a flick from this era. The creature is decent, though it's hard to find him intimidating when you hear the characters compare him to a vegetable. I think my favorite moment is the build-up to the creature's reveal when the characters search the halls of the research station for the villainous carrot. I found the character of the reporter to be a headache, and I felt they could have done without the romantic subplot. Anyway, it is easy to see why this is regarded as a classic film.
All right, so appears that Abe was a fan of the film, like all of us. Though Eric was a little less than us, he still liked it too. So that's good. All right, very good. Thank you, Chrissy, and thanks, Abe. And we'll see Abe hopefully next week when we did our 400th episode poll on Facebook. Basically, 16 films were picked by the group of us. For those on Facebook or the Dark Discussions podcast group to vote on for us to do as the 400th episode of the podcast, which was just a couple of weeks ago, I had chosen this as one of the films. And so one of the 16 films was actually this film, but it did not win. So interesting that we're a couple of weeks later doing it anyway. So, Eric, do we have a wiki for this one?
Wiki. All right. Sorry, I lost my place on the page. Scientists and an American Air Force... Sorry, let me do that again. Scientists and American Air Force officials fend off a bloodthirsty alien organism while at a remote Arctic outpost.
All right, very well. A couple things that are interesting is that the first half of this film and the second half of John Carpenter's remake... If you merge them together, it's pretty close to the novella. While both films are quite different, they're in the other half. So this one, the second half, and John Carpenter's the first half are a bit different. Yet the other parts were fairly loyal to the book. This film here actually takes place in the North Pole, while the short story and John Carpenter's takes place in Antarctica.
You forgot the 2011 The Thing.
I tried to.
One more time, is not a remake.
It's a terrible film. That's what it is. It
doesn't matter. Just poking Phil.
it's pretty rotten. So that's some other information. I know... Chrissy wanted to mention some stuff about the set designer, and we'll get into that. Mike had some other stuff that he said you wanted to bring up, too. But before we put up the spoiler alert for this almost 70-year-old film, any general items that people wanted to bring up related to this film that wouldn't necessarily spoil anything.
Well, I'll mention that The Thing himself is played, as you said, by James Arness, and that might not mean a lot to
Norwegian American
other than those who are obsessed with people's heritage. It may not mean a lot to them, but he was actually the star of the TV series Gunsmoke, which for years was the longest running network television show, live action television show. Hour-long drama, and this was his first role. It was a role he kind of disowned for a while because he felt embarrassed by it because he was just, you know, in cheesy monster makeup going, for a lot of the film. But there was some small historical trivia to that. And there was a scene at the end of the film where the thing is set on fire, and that's believed to be the first full-body burn in movie history.
Oh, no shit. That's interesting. Yeah.
So it's one of these things where if you don't know that, it doesn't, and even knowing that, it doesn't mean much. But then you start to understand, if you had never seen that in a film before, this is the first time people had seen it, you start to get a better appreciation of why it might have had a bit more of a shock and impact to those audiences in 1951.
And I'll say one thing, that scene, the remake does use as well, but the effects in that scene in 1951, as Chrissy mentioned earlier, was just amazing.
Yeah, that scene was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it sure was.
Which scene are we talking about?
The fire? Yes.
Oh, yeah. There's another one I want to talk about, too, once we give spoiler alerts that I thought was pretty amazing.
And I just want to mention that the real moral of this story is that scientists, I mean, if you know anybody who's a scientist or has something to do with science or teaches science, they're not to be trusted.
That was oddly, even though you're being wise ass to Mike, it is kind of true that the story was trying to say anti-nuclear weapons as well, and scientists playing with things that they don't understand. That was part of the subtext of this film. So even though you're saying a bit in jest, it's actually a good point, Eric. A really good point.
Well, damn it, I wasn't trying to make a good point. I was trying to have some fun. Fuck.
Son of a bitch. All right, so...
Well, look, I just had to... just to be safe, I had to explain to Pam we were watching the new season of American Horror Story, and a girl is attacked by a killer and hits the killer with a 2x4 and falls on the ground and she runs away. And I turned to my wife and I said, you know, just to be clear, if a killer attacks you and you hit him by the 2x4 and he falls down,
keep hitting him.
So while this particular scientist who mysteriously looks an awful lot like Vladimir Lenin, is a complete and total dumbass. I want to be clear that I would have been beating that thing while it was still in the block of ice.
Right. Well, and to be honest, even though he was the lead scientist and probably the lead person in the entire expedition up north, because he was the one that basically had full control of getting the military there and people there and whatever, a lot of his subordinates, scientists, disagreed with him, while others... stuck with them probably more on principle, not because they necessarily agreed with them. And a lot of it was, there's a good point where the lead actress in the film is talking about the scientist. Her character is called Nikki Nicholson. And she's talking to Captain Patrick Henry about the scientist. And she said something that was really interesting, I felt, and true, which is, you got to remember, he doesn't think the same way everybody else thinks, because
right, he's an alien too, because he's a communist and a scientist, and we don't trust those people.
Well, I don't think that's what she meant. What she meant was is that he looks at things a hell of a lot differently than the rest of us, and through a different prism, and not necessarily because he's an idiot or evil or anything like that. It's more
no, but he may have been a very good scientist, but he came to some very sketchy conclusions. You know, this thing comes out of a block of ice, attacks somebody. It's like, it's wiser than all of us. It's like, what was that based on?
His basing was that the spaceship was his, was the creature. So the creature has
smarter. I don't know that it's wiser or you know.
I'm not disagreeing with anything you say.
Yeah, he was willing to sacrifice people for what is clearly a thing. Now, there is another issue. You can completely revise what's going on in this film, and we'll get to it when we get to an important scene and about the alien's intent. But, you know, it is you can definitely read way too much into this. But, yes, it is very clearly a Cold War film. It's interesting to remember this is 1951, and we are 6 years less than 6 years, because it's early 51, from the end of World War II.
Right.
All those people you see in the film, their characters, and probably a lot of the actors would have served in the war.
They actually did, a lot of them. Yeah.
Right, and the photographer talks about being on Okinawa. You know, the news reporter. Right.
The news reporter.
So, you know, it's just a different thing. So you get a different, like. again, if they made this film today, you would have distrust of the military, distrust between the press and the soldiers, and you'd have a lot more conflict going on there than you really do for this film. It's, and it wouldn't be necessarily scientists versus the common man, you know, and the press wouldn't be lumped in with the common guys, with the soldiers. It's right. Just a very different perspective. I also want to give credit to them because there is a lot of soft-pedaled satire in this, in how they deal with the upper echelons of the military, where the general is always like two steps behind them for reasons, but it's a running right. gag through the film. Yep. There's a joke at the beginning of the film because they're in Anchorage and they mentioned they just got a shipment of pith helmets. So, I mean, just in terms of things like about bureaucratic incompetence, and, you know, it's like a running gag about the between the characters in the film, like anybody who has a job complaining about their higher ups.
Also, I did like when the professor, Dr. Arthur Carrington, contacts Anchorage to say we need someone up here. So, you know, because a ship crashed or a plane or whatever, everybody assumed it was possibly Russians. It's like, oh, it's probably a Russian spy plane or something. So, yeah. Yeah, so. But you're right. Everybody was more on board. There wasn't a polarization that you see today. You know, the war just ended 6 years earlier. Everybody had the same experience with the war. The press was rah-rah for the military and the country because, guess what? They just saved us from the Japanese fascists and the Nazis and put up the soldiers to hold back the Soviets. So, a lot of it was different, or than say what you would see today, where everybody would hate the press and hate the military and hate, you know, everything except for themselves. You know, while
except
here,
except for the unlucky teens that happened to wander onto the base at just the wrong time.
I don't get it.
That's if they were making the movie today, that would be.
Oh, right, right.
That's who you would have had.
Yes, you're probably right. Yep. All right. So, as you can see, we're probably going to discuss anything and everything. So we'll throw up the spoiler alert. So I guess we can begin discuss to just set it up. So the spoiler alert is up to set up the film. There's a Air Force. Division or whatnot in Anchorage, just doing what they do down there, watching the Soviets hanging out at the local bar. And this news reporter comes in, and he knows some of these soldiers, and that's the reason why he was there, because one of his friends told him, maybe, you know, if you're looking for a story, come up here. And when they're all there, they get a call that from this Carrington guy up in the North Pole that said that a unidentified airplane or something crashed and they need some folks to come up to investigate. And so the general, like you said, gets a crew to go. Some of them are grumbling because they were expecting to have leave and go to Florida or whatever. And then the news reporter asks if he could come, and they agree. And that's pretty much the setup of the film, right? Anybody else want to add anything?
No, that's it.
All right.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that's pretty much it. So.
Yeah, they set up the fact that the lead character had an issue with a woman, or the nominal lead character, which was Captain Pat, whatever it was.
Pat Hendry.
That, yeah. So, and that's becomes into play in the rest of the film because it's the 50s and, you know, you have to have a romantic interest in there, which is obviously the thing that John Carpenter cut out because he made a film with all men. Of course, if they remade it today, it would still be a film with all men, but there would also be a romantic interest.
Maybe he was – I don't know because the original short story doesn't have any women in it anyway.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know if he cut it out intentionally when he remade it or if he decided to go closer to the book. I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, it was important though. In that time in history in the 50s, it was important to have a love interest because, you know, these were date movies. They were drive-in movies. You know, there were women going to these movies. And if they wanted to get a bigger audience, yeah, always had to put something in there that appealed to the women, because the women always like to watch the relationships.
Right. Well, and that's a fair point, Chrissy, because, like, for example, Lawrence of Arabia, that movie almost wasn't made, and they were demanding changes because there is no woman in the film at all, and this was a huge blockbuster, and they said, we need women in the film. I mean, this, we want attract dates, audiences, we want to attract both genders and whatnot, and how's this film going to succeed? So you're absolutely right.
And you want a woman in, with you in the theater in case you're in the mood for a cup of coffee. You could send her to go get some for you.
Yes, or take your notes for you.
Or take your notes for you, right? For,
take
for the
your
podcast.
Notes for you.
Well, actually, her job, she was
a secretary.
Secretary or office manager. So, I mean, obviously the note part makes sense.
Yeah, but if you can make a drinking game of the number of times she walks into the scene bringing in the pot of coffee.
Yeah, there, it happens like 5 times.
Gotcha. I didn't even pay attention to that, but yeah, you're probably right. I believe you.
And of course, she's the, in her own way, in her special feminine wiles sort of way, she's the most clever one of them all, you know, because she matches wits with the captain for no particular reason other than so she can tie him up and snare him as a husband. You know, it's, you know, look, that was a thing, you know, it was the mentality of a lot of women back then, right? You got a job to get a man. So yeah. there is, it may be in politic to point it out, but those were the gender politics of the day.
Yeah, well, but yeah. It's a little different here because, I mean, she was up in the North Pole, right? I mean, she was doing a job that, though surrounded by men, that was it the main point? The thing is she knew this guy who happened to fly from Anchorage, and that's where that dynamic came. Of course, it's staged in the 50s as a 50s type of relationship, but it at least makes sense for the story. But go on.
Oh, I strongly suspect in the 50s that she would have been considered a strong female character.
Oh, absolutely.
Now,
yeah,
they would be crucified for it.
Absolutely. The moment when she ties his hands behind his back and is pouring the liquor down his throat. I mean, this was one of these moments
where I was like,
that is almost so like
subversive in a way.
Gay and ballsy for a 50s like drive-in film. Do you know what I mean? Like for something that was going to be sort of mainstream. But what I liked about their kind of relationship was that we got the sense from their initial conversation that the tryst that they had was pretty crazy. I mean, you know,
it sounded like the way they acted would have been
acceptable for the time, I think.
The way they acted and discussed their prior relationship, it sounded a lot like soldiers on leave, that type of thing, or, you know, like spring break for adults type of thing. So so their relationship I didn't really scratch my head at it as a 1950s weird backward thing. I looked at it as, oddly, in a more modern era where, you know, people on vacation and partying it up, and a lot of adults do that, you know. And
you can say what you want about, you know, the secretary and she's the most clever of them all. But I come from a very long line of secretaries and receptionists because all the women in my family were creative and that was the work they could get in the 30s, 40s and 50s. So that's what they did. But, you know, let me tell you something. The buck stops at the secretary's desk. She knows everything that's going on with everybody. So she's the gatekeeper. So if you really, and she keeps things organized and keeps things running, because God knows 15 men in a place like that couldn't find freaking their asshole with both hands in the dark and they'd lose shit. So, you know, she is a very important character anyway. So it's interesting to see that, to watch this movie in that in the 50s, that was really a respected job. Like that was an important job. They ran the freaking companies of the world, you know? And I think we forget that now because we get swept up in all this other stuff.
I'm mentoring a teacher, and I told him, I said, you have to remember there are only two groups of people you need to keep happy in this building, and they're the secretaries and the custodians. You know, it's like everybody else you can work. They're the most important people. You must keep them happy, and they will take care of you. What I was specifically referring to was, of course, that as she was pouring their coffee for them, because she's a woman and she knows how to cook, she figures out how to kill the vegetable by boiling it. You know.
That was pretty fucking
funny, actually.
I didn't get any of these things. That
you no. She didn't say that. What they did was they asked her. They said, "How do you cook vegetables?"
No. She's there. They're talking. How do you kill it? And she interrupts. She says, "You boil it." You know, and then and then she just goes through the different ways you do vegetables in cooking. She throws it in as kind of an aside, and she inserts herself into that comment. They don't ask her at first.
Aloud kind of thing, like, how do you kill a vegetable? That, because right. I think I remember
that. And then
she question.
Says, you boil it because.
Yep.
Right. Right. But again, it also makes sense for that time period where. You know, the men are trying to figure out what the fuck do you do. Probably don't know how to cook anything because they didn't take home ec in school. They took shop.
And plus, in the military, if you weren't the cook,
right,
you didn't do it cooking.
Right, and so and she would have, because if you were a woman in the 50s, she would have been growing up in the 30s or 40s, you would have learned how to cook. So she's going to come at it from a completely different angle. Right. You know, I don't have a problem at all with it in the film. I just kind of laugh at it because I can hear the whiny people today watching it and being, you know, having to cover their faces to avoid being offended by the Neanderthals and celluloid.
Well, you know, we've had this discussion many times on this podcast, is that the problem with today, I think, and all the whining that goes on is that everybody just wants to pretend that the past didn't happen. And the reality is it did happen. And if we do not recognize what went on, we are doomed to repeat it. So quit with the whining. Stop looking at it through a 2019 filter and go back and read your history and talk to people who lived during that time to see what it was like and get a sense of what the world used to be. You know, and that's kind of the way I look at this now, like where they're all like remaking this and remaking that. And, oh, we got to ban this because so-and-so was a racist in 1840. Okay, whatever. Well, everybody was a racist.
There's no smoking.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no smoking ever anymore anywhere. They did not do that in the 50s. Well, no, actually, they did. Everybody did. I got news for you. So I think the real message here is that when you go and watch any film, whether it's from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, you really need to approach it in context and really try not to look at it from the way we see it today. You have to look at it like all these cracks about the Russians and the nuclear thing. That was a big deal. People were terrified in the 50s that the Russians were going to nuke us.
Right.
You know, and it was
scary. You're absolutely right. You have to keep in mind the time in which the movie was made. Sometimes Doug from Horror Etc. is now doing a podcast called The Midnight Drive-In, where they often end up watching a lot of 80s movies. And one of the lines he likes to use repeatedly on that show is, well, it was kind of rapey, but that was okay in the 80s.
Because things are different then.
Yeah.
Right, right. I mean, back in the 70s, you could have nudity, you know, see women's breasts in PG films, you know, and now, you know, that's an automatic R.
I like the fact that in terms of like perspective for the time, you notice what they never call anything there. They never call the thing an alien.
Yep.
It's a visitor, a man from Mars. It's not an alien. The terminology isn't there yet.
Right.
They talk about his airship, not his
right.
Not his spaceship.
Right,
right.
You know,
flying saucer.
It's a flying saucer, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Or flying saucer, because
I did enjoy that scene when they were figuring out what was in the ice, where they all fan out and figure out that it's a round craft, and yeah. That moment with the music, dun dun dun, it's round.
We found one. That was awesome. That was awesome.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was like they really exist. We really found it. This is the biggest news ever. And I'm just sitting there like, oh my God. Like, it was really great.
But I love the fact.
It is the biggest news ever, if it was true.
Right? I love the fact that in reading up on this a little bit, because you know now, like, if you want to get the cooperation of the military, you know, so you can do military porn and get to use all their guns and weapons and ships and stuff. The military refused to work with them. The Air Force refused to work with them, and the reason they refused to work with them because they were afraid it would undermine their policy of saying that flying saucers were not real.
Oh yeah, and I love that where they're in the airplane, and the guy has this like Air Force magazine, and it's like we don't know how old it is, but he's like, oh, and did you read this? It's this episode, it's this issue on this
great.
Page
yeah, yeah,
with this awesome. And this statute and blah blah blah, and it was like, oh my God, like that was just great. Like,
well, and then the pilot, the co-pilot makes a joke by going, and what episode did you say that was in? And then he lists 1737, and then the guy stops for a second. He goes, "Oh yeah, I remember
oh,
that." And then everybody,
oh yeah, that
snaps.
One, yeah,
yeah, because that was yeah. So they were awaking at us, and then they, you know, we're thinking the exact same thing that guy is, which is this guy's nuts that he knows all this. I don't know. That was funny. I thought, yeah,
and. Yeah, there was little things. There was the guy at the end when the thing is breaking into the room and he's going to shoot it with a flare gun. And Scotty, the reporter, says to him, "Do you know how to use that thing?" It's like, "Yeah, I saw Sergeant York in the theaters."
Oh yeah, I love that.
And it's like,
that
we're
so
all about to die, but I can give a smart-ass remark. I'm like, there's my spirit animal right there.
Well, and also one of the crack ups too in here that I really loved is that scene where they set him on fire. That scene just cracked me up because here they all are, right? They're getting ready to light things on fire and they're pouring kerosene. And the one guy says to the other, "Watch that smoke, like put out your cigarette."
That's
and you're
the
gonna
truth
light
too.
Up the Yeah, but you're gonna light the whole room on fire anyway. And then the guy says, anybody
well, you
want to
do it before
like,
you want to do it.
Yeah, you don't want to just light it on fire on mistake.
But the whole room goes up in flames, of course, because it's a wooden building, and they're all just running around in there. I was like, oh my God, this is crazy.
No, but it makes funny. Complete sense, because they're setting up the room to blow it up, you know, to burn it when the creature comes in. So if a guy's smoking a cigarette, it's like when I used to pump gas, you know, half the people I work with were smokers, and I would have to say, dude, smoke it over there. You're not smoking it over here, you know. And because if you mistakenly drop the butt, the whole place goes.
Hold on to your butts.
And so that was the point. Was we got to wait until the creature comes, and then, you know, we want the kerosene to go off. So I thought they paid attention to little details very well, because a lot of people would have said, "Why is that guy smoking?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did think they paid attention well, I thought it was funny because, again, this is a sign of the times. It would be considered bad writing now, but they explain everything. Like, for example, they use the term SOP. That's standard operating procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could write the obits. That's an obituary. You know, mm-hmm. but just in case, because they want to make sure that everyone is with it.
I would have never guessed what SOP meant unless they explained it. So
right, but then
really,
and well,
never heard it.
But you either say SOP or you say standard operating procedure. You don't say we're going to show how hip and with it we are by saying SOP. Oh, and then we're going to explain what SOP is for the operating audience. And that's sort of like the what was the movie we reviewed?
That one
where it's like TTFN, and then that's ta-ta for now. You know, they had
which board?
Right. So it was just weird because that happens a couple of times. There's a lot of times, and this is a where they over-explain things in the film, but I think all that comes back to the novel because it's something you get away with better in the novel. Like, how did we find the impact crater? How far away the thing went? Then they're talking about comparing the sound waves versus the seismic waves, which is how you find the epicenter of an earthquake. And there's a lot of times where they talk about stuff like that.
The whole vegetable thing was made up for this movie, though, right? That wasn't part of the story.
Pretty much. I mean, okay. I mean, the main change was to make it a veggie creature rather than a mammal or reptile animal versus plant. So a plant creature. You're absolutely right. So that was made up for the film. Yeah,
I was fairly certain it was. I just wanted verification.
Yeah, another change from the book and the John Carpenter movie too was the spaceship crashed that day that week, while in the book and in the the movie, the John Carpenter movie, it was in the ice for millions of years and they find it. So that was a change too.
Well, and another thing, I guess, classic of the time is that you never start a story then in media res, in the middle of things, right? We have to start with showing Scotty getting to the Anchorage base, and then they're going to hear the news of the spaceship crashing, and then we're going to follow them on their journey to the Anchorage base. You know, they don't do a cut to and later at the Anchorage base, or like they did in Carpenter, where you could pick up with them already there. You know, they made sure everybody, you were there for all the introductions of the characters, everybody walking on the screen, and it was just a matter of the style of storytelling at the time.
The spaceship exploding under the ice, that comes right from the novel, because they do use those thermal charges, and for whatever reason, that metal burns rather than just melts around it. So,
that always is one of my favorite lines in the film, where they get the message later from the general, because they're worried about they just fucked up the find of the century.
Yep.
And then they get the message saying, get it out of the ice with thermite. And they're like, oh, whoo. We're on the hook for that fuck up.
And I also like when the creature gets, I can't remember if it's before or after the creature away, but the guy says something about, and yes, I'm 12. The guy says something like, we already had one boner today. Let's make sure we don't have another.
Oh, yeah. That was hilarious. I was like, oh, my God. Did I just hear that? That's so great. But there was a whole lot of stuff like that. Like, there was one character who was one of the military guys, you know, in his very thin bomber jacket running around up in the ice or whatever. And he kept every time he talked, he would make a reference to a woman. Like, there was this hot nurse, or there was this nurse that came on shore and she did this or whatever. And then, like, later on, he would make another sexual, like, offhand reference to some other chick. And I was like, oh my God, dude, this is like, they're clearly trying to show the guy is obsessed with women. He even mentions it in the card game. And I just thought that was really clever because it was all very, subtle but quick. Like, it was there. Like, I just thought that despite some of the stilted line delivery, that these characters felt like real people to me. I really believed that these guys were who they said they were and that they weren't actors. You know what I mean? The way they were ripping each other and teasing each other and doing all of that, I thought was really great.
And what's interesting is that I had trouble. There really are a lot of characters in this film. Mm-hmm. Given how small of a setting it is, and you compare that to the Carpenter version where there's like eight guys there. Here there's a lot of people on this base, and the names come at you very quickly. They don't do – because they're all soldiers in uniform. In some degree, most of them except for –
Or the scientists. They're either scientists or soldiers and dressed all the same.
Right, and even the scientists, there's Dr. Carrington, the head scientist, who looks like Vladimir Lenin, and then he's got the Ronettes behind him, you know, who are just his backup scientists.
Right.
You know, you had the one guy, the base doctor, who just had very distinctive look, like very tall looking
guy. Yeah. He was always said smart things too.
Right. And his wife was on the base with him, which she has like a one or two very brief scenes, which I had never remembered. They don't go out of their way to go, oh, here's the guy who has the scar, and here's the one who, you know, whatever. Yeah, they don't go out of their way, you know, likes to play with knives. They don't go out of their way to give them forced quirks, mm-hmm. you know, to make them stand out. That does make it hard to keep track of who the characters are, but they still kind of have their own voice, like you were just saying. You know, right. So and they just kind of leave it to the audience to say, you'll follow along. Here's going to be the sarcastic guy playing, you know, who might have been, you know, who talks about, you know, the Sergeant York line. And here's the guy, you know, who's, you know, obsessed with women and whatever it was. And they still found them as real people. They weren't caricatures that the audience could keep straight.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. One of the guys, actor George Fenneman, he actually spoke a lot in the film, and his character, I mean, him in real life, he became one of those guys that did announcing. So he did commercials, and if you saw a trailer, he would be the guy that would say, "And the monster did, you know,
one of in a guys. World."
Yeah, exactly. So you heard, if you were around, and I've seen a lot of old films, so when I heard his voice in this film, that's the reason why I looked him up. I go, I got to find out who this guy is, because I know that voice. And then sure enough, I was right. He's done trailers and commercials and stuff. It's kind of funny. But you're right, though. All the folks, even the minimal characters, even though it was hard to put them together, it wasn't like, say, Alien... I mean, Prometheus, where the characters just blended together and they disappeared. Here, you kind of could see each of them as individuals, even if their characters were never really defined, which was kind of interesting how that worked. So it wasn't a massive issue, I felt, that you would see in other films.
And now you would have every character would have something quirky. Yep. They would, you know, here's the guy who was always flipping a coin. Whatever, you know, and then yeah. and you would have and a lot of them, you would have found out their backstory right before they were killed, so you could feel bad for them when they died. You know, and there was none of that. There's none of that sort of sentimentality. There is there's really four characters that really matter, which is Nikki, and who weirdly enough has top billing. Did you notice?
Well, that? Yeah. Well, she was actually. Yeah, I know. I thought it would have been. Kenneth Toby or Robert Conthwaite, the guy that played the doctor. But yeah, she was supposed to be a big star. She was supposed to star with John Wayne in a film a couple of years earlier, but she got pregnant and decided to pull out. And then
scandal.
And then, no, she was married and stuff. And then, or rather,
decided to not pull out, so she got pregnant. No, they pulled out, she got pregnant.
Then this film, you know, they gave her the lead, and then she was going to be a big star, but then she decided to start a family like 3 years later, and and then she just disappeared pretty much.
Yeah, she apparently wasn't happy with, because she was getting farmed out for TV roles, so it wasn't quite breaking out the way she wanted it to.
Right, yeah, exactly, and not to sound disappointing, but I guess she gained. A lot of weight or something too, which after she had the kids, and
it happens.
It does happen. Yeah. So the type of roles that she was supposed to do, obviously she didn't fit the role, I guess is what they were saying. But then I guess she lost the weight, but then she decided to just be a private person. The doctor, let's talk about the doctor. He did two things that were bad. One was he didn't report that he figured it out that the creature was living in the conservatory. And then the second thing he did was he started the plant, the seeds that he found off the creature, and he planted them, and he didn't notify anybody except for his inner circle. And so, yeah, so he was working somewhat against everybody, and
somewhat?
That was a bad thing. because he, a couple of his people died because he had people watching the conservatory and they got killed. And had he told people that the creature was there, no one would have got killed and so forth. Yeah. So he kind of fucked up.
Yeah. I saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I know what happens when you have alien seed pods. It's not a good thing.
No. Well, they do bring a good point about it too. When, about not releasing the creature from the ice, they said it could have germs, you know, like World War of the Worlds, you know, and that could come and could kill us all, you know, it could be something like that. Not, never mind the creature itself. So yeah, they dot their I's and, you know, slash their T's or whatever. So yeah, I mean, it's
right.
It's stuff.
And there's a lot of science in there, like I mentioned them, you know, or like the plausible science, remotely, you know, like using the waves to find the location of the ship, you know, stuff like that, that they talk about because it's a science fiction film. And, you know, science fiction books, certainly at the time, would have a tendency to squeeze real science in it.
Right.
You know, yeah, and
especially
so,
when it comes to John W. Campbell, because he's the guy that led the real science versus the space opera stuff.
Right. And right. So the more hard science fiction stuff, although I don't know that you could say the thing is truly hard science fiction, but there was a, I guess, you know, an attempt to educate the reader about science while they were doing it. And they're doing that with the film. They're not going too far out of their way, but they are kind of mentioning, and they are in some cases over explaining stuff. But it was nice because it shows that they are having these debates. They're having these discussions. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? Then the scientist just goes, hey, look, there's an alien monster trying to kill us all, and he can breed thousands and thousands of new seed pods. I'm just going to hide the fact that it's still alive, and I'm going to grow more seed pods and help him do that. It just... Because
well,
he's so wise.
I have to say, I really, that was one of the moments in the film where I thought the special effects were really impressive. That whole seed pod garden that he had, and I'm sure it was a very simple effect with like air bladders inside of, you know, fake seed pods, but that shit looked really good and really realistically alive, I thought. The other moment I loved about that is when they were listening to it with the stethoscope, and I thought the drop line there was going to be, oh, it has a heartbeat. And instead they went with like the wail of a newborn child who's hungry. That was so disturbing. I was like, oh my God, that, I actually got a chill from that one line. I was like, that is great. So it was little things like that that I really appreciated in this movie, because there was some nice, creepy stuff that was just very unsettling and very different. And I did enjoy all the scientific explanations just because I thought they were actually very clear. Like, or we would be kind of the stand-in with the military guy, because the military guy would be like, well, I don't understand any of that. I just want to go blow it up. Like, you know,
right.
So you don't feel bad, you know, as an audience member going, okay, I have no idea what they just said. Like, you know, you didn't feel awful because the military guy didn't understand it either. So you didn't feel so bad. I just thought it was stuff like that. That really made this movie fun for me. I will agree with Eric. I think the best 50s movie I've ever seen in this vein really is Them. I mean, Them is really my favorite. But honestly, I would have to put this one kind of close second. I don't know why I love this so much. I just did.
Well, I think you also have things like War of the Worlds. I think you have the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I'm not sure how well The Fly holds up. I haven't seen that in a very long time. The original Fly, obviously. There is a lot of really good science fiction films from that era. A lot of really terrible science fiction films from that era, too. But there are a lot of
this one. This one's considered one of the good ones. Those were valid points, too, Chrissy, about the military guy, because he was willing to listen. He didn't shut anybody off, but he also would always say, well, my main point is to stop this creature from killing everybody, you know. And I thought that was good too, because he wasn't a dink you know, because he could have said, "We're just going to kill it," and, you know, whatever. He would listen, but he said, obviously, we have to follow the protocol, whatever the general says. So he would always go back to that, and then he would also say, "We also have to make sure no one passes, because obviously this creature is dangerous." And of course, the science guy was the complete opposite. He says, "This is an important find. We got to protect it, and we got to do this." And then, of course, the military. Every so often, when the connection got through, the general would say, "Make sure you keep the creature, and so forth. This is important," you know, on and on. So, I like this turmoil where he had to deal with what to do, and yet he never panicked. Also, I like that too. He was always rational.
It's kind of like both the directives in Alien, only through the same dude. Instead of, like, in Alien, you have Ash with his directive, and yep. then Ripley with hers. It's like those two directives being sent to the same person, and he's just like, all right.
Right.
Well, I gotta make a judgment call here.
And, you know, what's great, Eric, is that characters would use it against them. Like, the Carrington, the doctor would say, "Yeah, but what did the general say?" And then he would say, "Well, the general said to make sure the aliens, you know, safe." All right, there you go. Your answer. And he goes, "Yeah, I guess you're right." So
yeah, and the general. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Phil. Finish. And
I was just going to say, and even though the general said to do that, then his next goal would be to isolate the creature. So if he wasn't going to kill the creature, at least he would isolate it. While the professor was the one that was nefarious, because he would want to still talk to the creature or communicate with the creature. I guess not disobey the general, but read more into it. While our hero was specifically following the general, but also making sure the creature was isolated. But go on, Christian.
Oh, I was just going to say, I thought the general as an isolated character was interesting, right? Because we really only see him in the one scene in the beginning, and yet he is a presence throughout the entire film, and he can just never get there. So they're all basing their decisions on this guy who isn't even there. And then they're only getting pieces of the information anyway. And I just thought that was interesting. There was a piece that I read. There's been quite a bit of analysis written about this film. I have not had time to read all of it. But one of the thematic things in this film is the idea that how do we deal with something that is unknown that is threatening?
Suggest that we spread out and try to determine the size and shape.
Right. Spread out, everybody. We're going to try to figure out the shape of this thing.
Hear the call, sir.
It's almost...
Yeah. Almost a perfect...
It is. It's round.
We finally got one.
We found a flying saucer.
Can anybody see anything through the ice from where you are?
Only an outline.
Nothing but a duck shape here. Seems perfectly smooth. No doors or windows.
I can't see any engine.
I doubt if we find anything we call an engine.
Dr. Carrington.
This isn't any metal, I know. Probably some new alloy.
Get some filings for analysis.
Right.
Captain,
I don't think we have a chance of chopping through the ice with axes.
I know, Doctor. We think so, too. We're going to try to melt it out with thermite bombs.
Oh, excellent. Doctor, where do you figure it's from?
I don't know.
In other words, what voice do we listen to, or do we make our own decisions, and how do we go about doing that? That was one of the articles I read that was discussing this film. And I thought that was very interesting, just because if you look at this movie through that and keep that in your head, that is exactly one of the things this movie is addressing, right? They can't listen to the general because he's like not there. They're only getting part of the messages. And so it's really up to them to like figure out what they want to do. You know what I mean? And I think that for the time period we were in, we were going into the Cold War, right? The McCarthy stuff was going on. I think a lot of the American public felt kind of helpless. You know, what were our leaders going to do to protect us? Or are we just going to have to decide on our own what the heck we're going to do?
And I do think, though, part of it getting to the general and getting to Dr. Carrington, a lot of the 1950s, the authority figures are a good thing, right? You know, there's a shift when you go from the 50s and early 60s to the late 60s and 70s, where calling in the government goes from being the solution to the problem, right? You think of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where the goal is to get out of the town, and they inform the authorities at the end, and there's kind of a sense of it'll be okay because we got to the cops and told them about these terrible seed pods. You know, or, you know, we go for them. Who's going to fight the giant ants? The army will. And if they had made them in 1970, it would turn out to be the army that bred the giant ants to fight their war in Vietnam. But even though this is in the middle of the pro-establishment, it's all undercutting the establishment. It's undercutting the authority figures the entire time. The captain is the person in charge on the base. And Nikki is constantly undercutting him and holding him up, saying he's going to be the next general, you know, a general, what's his face? And the general is always giving bad orders, you know, because he's completely removed, completely unaware of what's going on. You know, the scientist is an authority figure. He almost gets everybody killed.
Yeah.
And how you brought up the general was brilliant because – I mean, you know, from Scotty saying, he said, thank God the general said use the thermite shed just because it covers our ass, because the general was like this ominous presence that if we disobey him, we're in trouble.
But they're also not ominous figures. The scientist is a fool.
Yeah.
The general is an out-of-touch buffoon, right? They're not mean. They're not vindictive. They're not conspiring. Well, I mean, okay, the scientist is conspiring. That's a bad example. But they're just – it's again, the idea that, you know, people sometimes don't know what the fuck they're doing. And I have to think a lot of that, you know, a lot of the people who were probably in the war probably had plenty of battle plans that went wrong. You know, they were probably in a lot of situations where they saw things go to shit because the brass didn't know what they were doing.
Right, right.
And we all see – anyone who has ever had a job working for somebody has dealt with that too.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And the Korean War was going on at this point too, I think. So every point you make, Mike, is correct. There's so many people that were in situations that went who knows how because, you know, war is, you know, unpredictable. And I guess the military here, even though it was a well-run machine where everybody was following orders, but you did have the civilians who were kind of going, we want to do it our way. We want to save the creature or whatever. And then you have the general who isn't on the battlefield. And then you have the soldiers who are on the battlefield seeing it firsthand. You know, so I think that could have been also part of the screenplay and how it was written was for the fact that they were showing a general who wasn't there making orders. And yet all the people on the base are the ones that are actually fighting, just like in real battle, right? I mean, you have your general in the back that's never firing a gun, and then all the people up front that are actually seeing this is how it really is. I mean, we saw that in Platoon was one of the better examples of that. So what did you guys think of the alien as a threat? I mean, obviously the fire didn't kill it, and it was pretty strong.
I do not think they should have introduced the phrase giant carrot to the movie.
I agree.
Because it's stuck in my head, and that's all I can think of.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought that was just a little silly. I mean, I was buying the plant idea. They did mention a couple of plants, like the telegraph vine, I think that's kind of bullshit that they actually communicate. I do know that they dance or something like that. And certainly there's like the Rafflesia, the corpse flower, and all this, which they didn't mention in the movie. But there is such a thing as quote intelligent plant life. But I agree, Eric, that carrot line just blew my, I was like, dude, I'm done now. Cause then when the guy started coming through the door and it's supposed to be all scary, I just start laughing.
It's thinking, carrot man.
It's carrot man. Like, yeah, totally. That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, well, like I said, when I was 11 years old and I walked in, my father watching the film, I said, what's the creature? He goes, oh, it's a vegetable monster. You know, and that always stuck with me. My mind, when he told me that, because I never got to see the creature because I went to bed, I just thought of, like, you know, one of those fruit commercials where they have the
fruit of the woman.
Yeah, yeah, not like that, but like the woman fruit that had like all the different fruits hanging from her and stuff. That, but she was a fruit herself. I can't remember the commercial, but it was something like that.
Chiquita banana or something.
Yeah,
or...
yeah, exactly, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, here's the biggest problem I have with that is, one, you're right. It's a silly thing. The imagery they use of the giant carrot.
Right. It was
However, it's intentional, but because it's probably the same guy, the smart-ass guy who made the comment about the magazine and made the comment about Sergeant York, made the smart-ass comment about the carrot, but then that just keeps that image coming to mind. They wanted to use the shape-shifting alien. They just didn't have the ability to do it, and they were looking to do something alien, but you'd never see the thing, right? So... And I've seen pictures of the makeup, and they have all this like vegetative theme stuff in there. If you actually look at the hand very closely, there's thorns growing out of it, but you never see it. It could be anything. So the whole vegetable theme, except for the fact you have the blood garden, you know, really doesn't pay off to any degree. And it just kind of creates a silly thing. And I guess that's part of the problem I have with the film in hindsight is that rule number one in filmmaking is don't tell, show. This film tells everything and shows next to nothing for reasons. You know, they didn't have the ability to show stuff then that they could show now. But like the thing broke into the greenhouse and killed two people and hung them up. We never see it, you know.
They're, I mean, that may be because, I guess they could have showed silhouettes of the corpses, but yeah, obviously, in that
or
day,
showed a scene of it breaking into the greenhouse and the men screaming or something. There's things they could have done, and I guess at the time, and look, it scared the shit out of my father, you know, when he was 9. Or maybe 10, because he would have been, you know, turned 10 about a month after it came out. So I guess it was, for some people, a scary film for the time. And they didn't show hardly anything. You know, there are a couple of scenes, the Geiger counter scene, where they're building up the tension as 0.1, 0.2, 0.3.
I actually thought that was very effective.
Right. Right,
I really did. Really, I was like, that was really unsettling. That was scary. Yeah, I agree.
And it's all in the last like 20 minutes of the 23.
Aliens stole that.
Right, yeah. Aliens using the. I was just going to say the alien and aliens using the because Ridley Scott cites this
right.
One of his favorite films. So, you know, the motion detector, right? An alien, and then they use that again in Aliens. So that's great. And they use that and they open the door and there's the thing standing there. And then they decide to throw kerosene in their shelter and somehow, I don't know. And basically if you took him out and put in Herman Munster, could you really have told much of a difference?
I see your point. Yeah.
You know, and they said they couldn't make it work. Said, put a Frankenstein head on him, you know? So right. They gave him kind of the rounded, not rounded, the flat top. Right. You know, he's got the big bodysuit on. He's wearing a spacesuit, so you don't see much. He's basically another alien with a big head.
Right.
He never says anything, but I do think it may be. Let's remember, he wakes up, right? His airplane crashes.
Yep.
His aircraft crashes, and he gets frozen. He wakes up, and he's in a strange place. For probably reasonable reasons, he doesn't speak English.
Yep.
And
this
the
is
guy,
what Carrington says all this stuff.
Right, and the guy that's there watching him just sees him, turns around, and just starts shooting him. You know, he's up, bang, bang, bang. It's like, well, we don't know what he did. We were never given any justifiable reason for him to just start blasting away at the thing. Just like, he's awake! Bang!
I did like how in the climactic scene when they electrocute the Carrot Man, how he gets physically smaller. I thought that was a neat touch that added something to it when the initial form of the monsters that enters the room is kind of cheesy. And I also particularly enjoy how the guy with the camera just totally fucking froze up, and he had the opportunity to get pictures of a lifetime and just sat there motionless until he fainted. I thought that was kind of funny.
It was. There was two scenes related to that were really cool. One was when everybody goes to the generator room and I felt that was cool because, like in the remake, the generator the alien takes, right? And so they're all going to die. But in this one, they're smart and they say, well, you know what? Let's all get to the generator room because the rest of the place is gone from power. And then the other thing I thought was cool too was when they set up the trap for the creature, they had to have the creature walk on the electric wire or it wouldn't work. And so they were smart to put down the little boardwalk, and then
right,
when
chicken
the creature
wire as a conductor,
yeah, and then when they used the boardwalk to hide the chicken wire, and then they see that the creature isn't walking on the boardwalk, so they throw something at it and it jumps onto the boardwalk. And I thought that was cool too because
that was a nice touch.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So they were doing a lot of detailed things that you know you wouldn't expect.
Little things to amp up the action and the tension in a movie where there really isn't a lot of action they can do because it's just a man with a wooden board.
Right.
You know,
well, and here's the other thing I found interesting, which is why I really liked the way this script was built, was because every time you turn around, there's conflict. This is honestly one of those movies where every conversation that everybody has with anybody has a conflict. Even in the there is at no time a scene that is just here's a bunch of dialogue for the benefit of the audience to understand this. It's here's a bunch of dialogue for the audience to understand this, but we're going to put this in an argumentative context so that it's interesting. Like, I mean, every single scene I noticed that had conflict. There was no conversation that did not have some kind of conflict in it. And I think that was important because this movie otherwise could have been very bad and very slow and not very interesting if they had not done that.
And there are plenty of 50s science fiction films that are about people standing around and talking. About, oh, we must solve this problem. Yes, we should. What should we do? We need to go consult the doctor. Yes, let us go consult the doctor. Let's go to the car, get in the car and go drive to the doctor. Here we are driving to the doctors. I hope he has a solution to that. You know, some of the really bad, very stilted, you know, and one of the things I'm thinking about it now that you mention it, and it's not, you know, conflict, but it's a base full of guys. They're constantly cutting into each other verbally. You know, they're jabbing at each other, which guys tend to do.
Yep. And that's one of the reasons why I thought it was so natural, you know, because it's like a whole bunch of guys sitting around picking on each other. And I'm like, yep, this looks about right. Like, but there really was it. Like I said, there was conflict in every single scene and every conversation. And I think that really made a very big difference.
Well, actually, you know what? Let me switch gears because at this point in time, there was a lot of ones in this era that were science fiction that decided to use color, and color is great. But since they didn't have the money to use color for this film, I have to say that they used the black and white for photography and the shading, almost like a film noir in a sense in various points.
Yeah.
I felt that really, like you said, Mike, too, that helped build tension that wouldn't have been there otherwise if they used color.
And I don't know what the economics of movie making was in 1951, One of the things I was reading is they gave the budget and they said in 2015 dollars or whatever it was basically a $370,000 movie. So you're talking today, this movie was made for a budget of less than $500,000. This is a low budget film by today's standards. Now, I don't know if that was low budget by their standards then, right? But it is all on a couple of sets, a guy in costume, you know, and one big set piece kind of at the end. So it is kind of remarkable that they got all that done using really very, very little.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And Mike, you mentioned some other films that are considered classics of this era, too, that you liked a lot, such as Forbidden Planet and War of the Worlds and so forth. And this one doesn't even have the budget of those films. And yet, so it has to do different things to make it, I guess, stand out. And I think they did kind of. And like you said, like, you know, like we've said about the movie Jaws and what we've seen in the documentaries and all that, the creature in that, you know, they had malfunctions. So they didn't, it was silhouetted or showed it limited, so it was just a threat that it was there. Same here, where they didn't have the budget to make the alien that could shapeshift and take the form of other people. They decided to use the shadows and things like that to cover up the issues they had with the suit, which, when you look at the creature, it's like, oh, it's just Frankenstein. But because we don't see it, I guess it makes it a little more scary in a sense, because as we see in Frankenstein Monster, he becomes a character, and we learn about him and that he has issues and that, you know, he's just misunderstood and whatever. And in this one here, we just never really know anything about the creature. And I think that kind of helped that, I guess, the suit was a crappy suit if they had shown it, you know, in full light.
Well, it's the shark, but I think, you know, in Jaws, but I think this is part of where they say, well, it's, you know, it's scarier when you don't show it. Well, sometimes it's scary when you don't show it, because that school of thinking comes from when they couldn't show it. Now, it still has to do with not what, you know, how much do you show or how much you not show, as it is how you show it and how do you present it. And now we've gone from, the Dance of the Seven Veils to just a, stripper dancing on a pole, right? They just said, oh, look at all the effects we can do. We're just going to throw it all out there for the audience to see and stick money down the G-string, as opposed to
what the unveiling it artfully. Where are you
going? In other words, like, it's how you show it, right? It's how do you, like, you look at the Tyrannosaurus Rex from Jurassic Park, right? Great special, a great scene, but it's not because these special effects necessarily are great, although they are. It's how is it presented? And now they just know, oh, we can throw it out there and it'll look great. And so they just kind of go, look, Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, they don't necessarily put a lot of these films the same artistry in showing what they do have when they have something to show.
So now do you understand where he was going, Eric?
I guess.
You know what the Dance of the Seven, it's like seductive. It's presentation, it's style. It's not just flashing your tits out.
I just wanted to be an odd analogy, is all.
It was definitely an odd analogy, but my brain went there. What can I say?
It's definitely the thing is that when you don't have the money to do what you want to do, you have to find not band-aids but workarounds, and I think they did that quite well in this film.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, Mike, you know, had a good point. The budget isn't humongous. It's just a couple of rooms, pretty much. And even the spaceship in the ice was probably on a soundstage. Actually, it was.
One of the pieces of trivia is when they track the explosion of the thermite, the camera pans up, and if you look close, you can actually see the top of the backdrop that they had on the soundstage.
All the ice scenes were filmed in a ice plant. They used the ice plant for all the ice stuff, you know, the outdoor stuff, and then the indoor stuff, I think, was all, you know, local soundstage type stuff.
Except for the scene where you could see their breath.
Yeah, I want to correct myself. So I found the quote of the budget. I think in reading it now more closely, although it's not clear, the $40,000, whatever it was, that's $400,000, is probably the cost of the thing suit, not the thing, the movie.
Gotcha.
Just seeing other things that have the cost at the time of being $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Which is still, I don't know. But being a Howard Hawks film, I imagine a lot of that money went to him.
Right. The thing that's interesting about that scene, Eric, where you said you could see their breath. I always loved that scene because near the same period when I first saw this film, I saw Kill Bill Volume 1, and is the scene when Lucy Liu is fighting the bride in the Winter Garden, and when they talk a lot in that, and there's no breath, and it always bothered me because Quentin Tarantino forgot to add the CGI breath. So back in the day, when they needed to do this, they actually had to make freezing rooms to get the breath, and they did it. You know, and I always thought that was impressive, especially.
Well, this is an interesting fact I actually learned from watching the director's commentary on the Adam Green movie called Frozen, which is that when they actually shot that on location at a ski resort, and it was actually so cold that you couldn't see the actor's breath, because after a while they started suffering from hypothermia. And you couldn't really see their breath anymore, so they'd have to do things like I think they give them hot water and stuff to try and drink to keep their breath hot so it'd show up in the air or something. It actually got so cold that they were having trouble seeing the breath in the air, and they wanted to.
That's too funny.
Yeah, I actually felt, well, it's a legitimate point. I kind of like the fact they didn't put the CGI breath in there, because at the time that Kill Bill came out, CGI breath looked like shit.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Right.
Well, then he should have had it in a cold room.
Yeah, he just did a black and white sequence where people's arms and legs are popping off and spraying blood out of garden hoses.
But the breath is the real problem.
That's unrealistic.
That really bothered me.
Right. That didn't bother me. The film had literally, you know, and actually had literally just done an animated segment. So the film was already kind of cartoonish. So I was perfectly, that's not going to bug me.
That wasn't my point. My point was that the thing really went out to make it realistic in an era where they didn't have any effects to do it unless they actually did it. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So, well, shit looked better. Shit generally looks better when you just do it instead of like trying to do an effect. Like I always think back to the movie The Hitcher, when there's a gas station that blows up, and back in the mid-80s, the way you got that on film is to blow up a gas station.
Yeah. Like,
no CGI.
How did you do that? There. We did it. You know.
Right. Right.
We actually blew up a real gas station. Well, yeah, and there's things that you can't do convincingly practically. Not necessarily a lot of them, but there are things. Or for budget purposes or for convenience sake. But when you have the technology to do it practically, it usually looks better. Now, we can point out, and I always love pointing out where there are sometimes people complained, like my God, that looks so fake. It looks, you know, the CGI is terrible. And you point out to them, no, that was a practical effect. But they just didn't like the practical effect, or the practical effect was so good, it looked like it was CGI. You
know? Right.
Look at what they can do now with makeup and that they couldn't do in James Arness's day.
Sure.
You could do
the whole fire scene, right? I mean, that's real fire.
Right. And that's a good example. I think that setting people on fire is much more fun in real life than on video games. You know, when you see a movie, you can tell the difference a lot of times, or I can tell the difference, or I think I can, I should say, between really setting a person on fire and using crappy CGI to set somebody on fire.
Well, and one of the pieces of trivia I did read, I was not aware that it was the first burn, but I did read that the guy in the suit was breathing 100% oxygen in that scene when they lit him on fire. And oxygen, 100% oxygen, makes fire more fire. So it's like a miracle that he didn't die during that scene, because he was breathing 100% oxygen when they lit him on fire.
Wow.
And given that it's like literally the first thing they learned about oxygen when they discovered oxygen, you know, it's not like you can say, well, they didn't know oxygen caused fire to burn back in 1951. You know, yeah, that was a dumb idea.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they just dropped nukes. So if they could make nukes back then, they knew about
oxygen. Oh, yeah. It's one of the first things that Joseph Priestley learned about oxygen. You know, that was it makes fire burn brighter.
Yep. The thing that was interesting about that, too, was like they have the woman character, Nikki, holding the bed.
The mattress. That was one of those moments where I was like, oh my God, seriously, you're going to hide her behind a flammable mattress.
Right. Well, okay. No, but when they threw the kerosene, when they threw the kerosene on the creature, it goes all over the mattress and that
whole
area burns up. And it's like,
that I'll give them credit for the fire scene, because that scene was fucking balls to the wall. It's like, holy shit, what is going on here?
Yeah. Yeah, I really loved that scene. I just was sitting there going, oh my God, they are running around in this wooden building. It's really on fire. And everybody's just so casual about it.
Real gasoline.
Let's watch the creature burn. Like, nobody's running for their lives or anything. They're all just fucking sitting there watching this thing go up. And I was just like, oh my God. You know what? Honestly, it's fun. Just to watch that scene would be awesome. Do you know what I mean? Just watch the movie just for that scene, because it's so cool.
And I know I just watched it. I should know the answer to this. Did they have time to set that trap, or was that when they were sitting around in the mess hall talking about it, and they come up with the cook it, boil it, whatever, and was that when like the Geiger counter started going? So did they have time to really think this one through? Because I think they would have gotten Nikki out of there and not said, okay, we're going to set a trap for it. Nikki, stand by the door with a mattress in front of you.
Yeah, no. What it was is they were preparing for an attack, but the creature just showed up at that moment. It was like, holy shit, we got to move quick.
Right, so it was caught in my surprise, right? So, yeah. And that's my point. So
that makes more sense that everything went to hell. Right.
And we've done, for Christ's sake, one time I put out without thinking, realizing it was a grease fire, and in the chemistry lab, I dumped water on a grease fire. It's like, oh, fuck, you dumbass. I just hadn't realized what the kids had set on fire, you know, but in the heat of the moment.
Right. So you get napalm, basically.
Yeah.
In your classroom. And then when the creature breaks through the window and escapes, it's literally Palmer from the remake. I mean, they did a shot by shot remake of it.
Yes.
Yeah, and
sort of like they did in It Chapter 2 with the head.
That's true. Even though that head was not related.
But yes.
Yes, they did. Let's see. Anything else anybody want to bring up? Was there any scenes or things that we missed that people wanted to talk about?
Maybe. Well, I do think the end of the film is one of the classic closing lines in cinema history. The watch the skies. And, you know, again, it's Cold War. Beware, they're coming for you. even though they won, right? It's not like War of the Worlds comes out 2 years later. You know, humanity is almost wiped off the map, saved by bacteria. And yet, you know, it ends with church bells ringing and the choir singing and, you know, hopeful, you know. Religious.
Hope is bullshit.
Yeah, there's no hope in this one. They're coming. Oh, the best line though that was when Scotty's reading the report over the radio. He covers up for Carrington, And he goes, Dr. Carrington gets hurt during the battle. And then right. One of those soldiers says, good for you, Scotty. And I thought that was good because, again, everybody knew that Carrington was a fuck-up, but he wasn't evil.
He wasn't evil, and he's still one of them.
He's just a misguided scientist that you can't trust.
He was there with them in the battlefield. And as dumb as a move as it was, he was trying to help everybody, but as dumb, although admittedly he was willing to let everybody die.
I
should all die for science.
I might be paraphrasing. No! I'm pretty sure he suggested that everybody should just die and let this thing go.
But the guy did have the balls to run up to it.
Yes.
And try to talk peace.
Right.
And take a board upside the head.
Yeah, and he got bitch slapped and unfortunately did not land on the electrical grid when he fell down.
Right. Yeah, he broke his arm.
Awesome.
Yeah. You're so much smarter than us. Ah!
Well, he would have got his wish, I guess, right? Died, for science.
I want to see that alternate scene.
Right. Again, though, I mean, even though it's quote-unquote not necessarily 100% hopeful at the end, it also could be just the reporter and what they had just gone through, for that matter, embellishing a bit. Like, they're more coming. They don't know that. It could have just been a fluke.
Well, they don't know the more news. Aren't.
That's true, too, Eric. Yeah.
Better safe than sorry, right?
Yeah. That's
well,
true.
Let's be. They should be glad that this wasn't made in 2019 because.
Right.
Because then
would have been turned over to the authorities. But go on.
Oh, God, no. They would have done the Return of the Living Dead solution for the base. They would have just dropped the nuke on it.
Right. That's true.
Scotty would have been then like Skyping or FaceTiming. This giant plant monster is going to kill us, and a crazy scientist has bred thousands of them in the lab.
Right. Exactly.
Yep. But then the radiation will just make the plant creatures bigger.
Right.
Well, no. The last shot of the movie will be like a shot of something growing under the ice.
You would have the environmentalists complaining that we dropped the nuke on them. It's like,
yeah.
But the aliens were coming. We had to do it.
There'll be a 100-story tall James Arness coming out of the ice, and you cut to Ken Watanabe going, let them fight.
The creature was sent here. It's part of nature now, and blah blah.
It's part of the natural order from Mars, you dumbass. Oh, God.
Yeah, I love how they were still calling aliens Martians back then.
That's true.
Eric, we call that quaint.
Yeah. It's good quaint. Oh, but I didn't realize there was no laws for the life on Mars then.
Well, even Scotty says the little green men, right, and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, all that good.
But it does beg the question, when did we start using the term aliens to refer to things other than people from other countries? Right? So we went from visitor. I remember that term being frequent, visitor from another planet, little green men. Martians, all right, Martians we can throw away because we understand. Martians, little green men are a little too specific.
Grays.
Because maybe they're not. Maybe they're more pale pink. But whatever they are, I mean, when did we start using the term alien frequently?
Clearly before 1979.
Yeah, because they would say spacemen. Yeah. They wouldn't say aliens. They say the spacemen.
Or spacemen, right? You would hear that. Men from space, that was another thing.
Yeah. And then political correctness guy, and they started saying space person.
Space people. Yep. Right.
Well, they shouldn't say space person because they say
and they were like,
the word sun is in person.
And they said, no,
oh
no.
Oh, my God.
No. Alien American. All right, fine.
Alien American.
And then someone said, but they're not all... But they're not all landing in America. There's rednecks that are getting anal probed all around the world. All right, fine. We'll just drop the American and make them aliens.
It, well, it's like me now saying a behavioral health individual.
They're crazy, Phil. They're crazy.
A behavioral health individual. Oh my god, I can't even deal with that.
Instead of saying drug addict, a behavioral health individual.
Junkie.
Oh my god, I can't breathe.
Last night we were recording an episode on Mindhunter, and part of the story of the season is set in Atlanta, and it really has to do with racial tension. And I was trying to look, and in the show, they refer to everybody as black because that was the term that was used in that era. And I was trying so hard to get Phil to say black during the episode last night. He just would not do it.
Just calling them Atlantan Americans.
That's right. Exactly. Individuals from Atlanta.
Oh my God.
But he didn't have trouble saying white folk.
No, he didn't.
That's right. Yeah.
Behavioral health individual.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Phil's smart not to play along because, you know, that went on for a long time.
Yeah. That's all right.
Naturalized citizens was
playing to my
for.
Victory in, oh my God, I can't even remember what the movie was, but it was the night that Phil was drinking absinthe. And I got
oh,
him.
Yeah.
To,
oh, wow.
Jerusalem.
Man.
Yeah.
Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you said the R word, right?
I said it a whole bunch, and I got you to say it eventually. So that is my victory.
The R word?
Yeah.
Yeah. Retard.
Retard. Yeah. Retard. Retard.
I don't know why I'm saying it.
Which I want to say, Phil, I did just get Jerusalem on DVD as part of a package with a couple of other movies. So, yeah, it was just funny that comes up. And we haven't talked about that film in like 3 years.
We clearly need to wrap this up.
Right. Well, we talked about it a little bit when we did the Gollum episode because it's the same directors.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. All right. So I think we can probably wrap it up. So before we do that and give our final thoughts, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancy Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it everywhere you can find this one, except iHeartRadio. We're not on there, but we're everywhere else.
Excellent. And
don't you miss the days, the early days, like episode 110, where it was just, you can find us on iTunes.
Right. Just,
yeah, so it's splintered out. It's terrible. There's just way too much stuff.
Stop giving us choices!
Now, it's fully edited now. Now, I just got to put it up now. But Mike, we're doing a new podcast, and we pushed back episode 2 to next month. Anyways, that's the reason why I haven't released the first episode yet. But what's this new podcast?
The new podcast, which is no longer brand spanking new. It's a little tarnished. There's some dings on the door, but it is the Cinema a la Carte podcast. Our first episode is Hostiles with a Z. No, Hostiles with a... No, that's the Killer Bees movie. No, that's Zombievers. It's Hostiles with an S. That's the full title, Hostiles with an S, which is the Western film that came out in 2017, starring Batman. And Batman's awesome mustache. He borrowed Sam Elliott's mustache.
That's true. He did.
For the film, and Scott Wilson was in it, and a bunch of other people who are blanking on their names right now. Gone Girl was there, and yeah. So check that film out. It is nothing at all like the dark discussions films that we usually cover, because it's just filled with rape and violence and genocide.
Keep on giving me shit about this, but people would have gotten pissed if we did a Western on this show.
I just think it was funny. We're going to strike a completely different tone by putting a hat on the topics.
Indeed. Now, Chrissy, you have a book out or something?
I do. My book is called The Shadows Behind. It is a collection of short stories. And in fact, Horror Fiction Review for the week of September 19th just gave it a really awesome review. It was amazing. And I was really, really happy about that. So you can find that on Amazon, and you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. And that's all I have to say.
And you should post a link to that review on the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group.
I will definitely do that. I've had a really crazy September because I kind of ended up writing three short stories on deadline and submitted them all. And so everything went to hell. Like my blog, just everything went to hell. And that's fine. That's great. I love it. But I kind of have to pull my head out of my ass now and get back to reality. But yeah, I will definitely put it there so that people can go check it out.
All right, very good. And so let's give our final thoughts on this film here. So let's start with you, Mike.
You know, like I said, this is a nostalgic favorite for me, and now has an even more personal meaning for me. It was nice to look at it and, you know, appreciate it for what it is and see it a little differently than what we've seen before. Like through new eyes, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So I do want to thank everybody for agreeing to do this, even though I know, was it on Phil? Was it one of your attempts to pick for the episode 400?
Yeah, absolutely was. Yeah, sure.
It was one of yours in your poll. And I'm just really glad to do this, at least in my mind, as a tribute to my father. So I want to thank you for this opportunity. If you
we have appreciation. We have to thank Chrissy, because when you weren't on the episode a couple of weeks ago, we did Ready or Not, she suggested it.
Yeah, I really kind of pushed for it because I really wanted us all to do it. I think we were all going to do it anyway, but I was just kind of like, I want to make sure it happens. So thank you for that,
yeah,
Phil.
We were all on board for doing it. Chrissy pushed to do it this week. She's like, let's do this for Mike.
All right, I appreciate it. And I didn't have to be this week because we have other films. We've got more coming out. And then October, there may or may not be some horror-related films coming out. what's the Grass
there's
movie?
Some holiday or something in October.
There's the Tall Grass or something like that coming out.
Yeah, Three from Hell is coming out where everybody can see it.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of other stuff.
All right. So, that's it. I'm done.
Fair enough. All right, for me, I love this film. It's just a great film. It came to me late in life because unlike a lot of the 1950s science fiction and horror films, I hadn't seen it until I was in my 20s. But it, especially the first half, how close to the book, it's just great. It's a great interpretation, and as Chrissy said, a lot of suspenseful and scary things for a 50s film. Again, don't expect to be scared being horror fans and being desensitized, but I could see how back when it first came out, this was the type of film that would like shock people. Big thumbs up. Eric.
I like this movie. I don't love it, but I don't think that's necessarily an issue with the movie. I think it's an issue with Eric and his having trouble with older movies. It has its moments. I didn't find it unentertaining, so I liked it well enough. You know, it's not going to be one of my favorites of all time, but I can appreciate its place in the spectrum of science fiction.
Very well, Chrissy.
I really love this film. I, too, had never seen it before, and I highly recommend it. I think as far as the 50s science fiction genre, or whatever you want to call it, is concerned, I think it's one of the better ones, and I definitely would invest time in watching it, especially if you are a fan of John Carpenter's The Thing, just so that you kind of get a sense of where this came from. But yeah, I highly recommend it, and it, like I said, it's fun. It's fun. Just enjoy it for what it is.
So that was 1951's The Thing from Another World, directed by Christian Nyby, produced by Howard Hawks, written by Charles Lederer, and based off of John W. Campbell's novella, Who Goes There. Highly acclaimed film. for the science fiction genre, never mind for the 1950s. And with all that stated, Eric, what do you need to do?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about The Thing from Another World. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.